Sir.
What is it, Taylor?
There are some newspaper men out front, sir.
Newspaper men?
Yes, sir. They'd like to interview you regarding stock market conditions.
Hmm. Newspaper men. How many are there?
Well, sir, there are 9 reporters and a gentleman from the New York Times.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and newsworthy events we have reached on the path toward peace and reconstruction. Today, September 8th, 1946, we present the 42nd in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today...
Hey, what do you mean? What do you mean? Hey!
Our subject for today...
All the news that's fit to print.
This is John McVain, your New York correspondent, reporting direct to the National Hour. Today, the National Hour proposes to devote this entire Sunday edition to a newspaper... a world-famous publication which passed its 50th anniversary of its purchase by Mr. Adolph Ox. We will recount its fall and rise, tracing its career from a bankrupt daily to a great metropolitan newspaper. Horatio Alger's heroes had nothing on this publication, for step by step, this paper can match them. The publication is The New York Times. Appearing in this special edition will be Robert U. Brown, the editor of Editor and Publisher magazine.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. Throughout the world today, words are flying regarding the nature of a free press. From public soapbox and from public rostrum where nations are gathered to write a piece, discussion rages. We in America have one idea of what a free press means, and today, through the story of the New York Times, we shall attempt to demonstrate what that idea is. And now let the presses roll.
Let's have some more coffee.
Yeah, okay. But as I was saying, our government's going to spend $4 million on that project.
No, not anymore. They've scrapped that idea. The government's decided to do something else.
Now, wait a minute. Who told you that?
The New York Times. That's who.
$130 million Americans read over 1,700 newspapers published in the United States, and each individual will swear by his favorite. Their newspapers are authorities in their lives. They are institutions of great prestige. Some of those newspapers have achieved the highest pinnacle of influence. Their prestige is enormous. Amongst these stands the New York Times. After 95 years of publishing, this newspaper holds a unique position in American journalism. And how it reached that position, well, thereby hangs our tale.
Memo to students of journalism. A newspaper's health can be diagnosed like a human being's. Circulation, excellent or alarming. Editorial pulse, firm or wavering. General tone, vigorous or flabby. Prognosis, promising or unfavorable. In 1896, the diagnosis and the prognosis of a certain New York paper was anything but good.
Hey, what do you read? What do you read? The Mercury, the Commercial Advertiser, the Recorder, Get Your Son, the Tribune, the Herald. Hey, what do you read? Hey.
A Times, please.
Don't carry it, mister. Hey, what do you read?
Hey, now, just a moment. This is the third day in a row you haven't been carrying the Times. Is something wrong?
Look, mister, I said I don't carry it. Nobody buys that newspaper. Hey, what do you read?
It was a day when great names were on the mastheads of New York newspapers. Charles A. Dana on the Sun's, Joseph Pulitzer on the World's, James Gordon Bennett on the Herald's, Whitelaw Reed on the Tribune's. Their newspapers were powerful and influential. Once upon a time, in the first 40 years of its life, the New York Times had shone in these journalistic heavens. But in 1896, it was almost a dead star. It was, in fact, bankrupt.
Bankrupt. Memo number two. Great newspaper men are often made on small-town newspapers. And in 1896, a young newspaper publisher returned home to Chattanooga after a trip to New York. His name was Adolph S. Ox.
Adolph!
Hello, Simpson.
When'd you get back from New York?
This morning.
Oh, you should have telegraphed me, Adolph. I'd have been down to the station to meet you. You know, the paper missed you. In fact, the whole staff missed you. Now we'll all feel like ourselves with you back.
Well, thanks, Simpson. I appreciate that. But I won't be staying in Chattanooga very long.
No? Where are you off to now?
Back to New York. You see, I bought a newspaper.
A what?
A newspaper. The New York Times.
Well, you're not serious. You're a small-town publisher, Adolph. What are you doing with a big city newspaper?
Well, it was a good bargain, Simpson. It was losing money.
How much?
About $100,000 a year.
And you bought it?
Yes. Its presses are old, dilapidated, and its circulation is only about 9,000 right
now. You must be crazy, Adolph. You bought a gold brick.
No, Simpson. I'm not so sure that I have. For the kind of newspaper I want to make of it, well, I think it's a peach.
When Adolph Ox returned to New York, he knew precisely what kind of a newspaper he wanted to make of the shattered New York Times. And toward that end, he went to work with a vigor.
The entire staff is present now, Mr. Ox.
Thank you. Gentlemen. Gentlemen, this is my first day as publisher of the New York Times. I've called you staff men together to tell you something. Something of my plans for the paper. There will be many changes.
See, Charlie?
No one will lose his job. The changes will be mainly in editorial policy.
I'm for that 100%, Mr. Ox. My feature section could use some new blood. I hope you plan on more cartoons.
No, I'm sorry. Not on more cartoons.
Might I hope that you plan on a strong tie with some political party, Mr. Ox? With that kind of backing, my circulation figures will jump...
Well, again, I must say I'm sorry. I don't plan on that.
Well, as news editor, Mr. Ox, I hope you figure on using news of a more... I'm sure you'll understand. I mean nothing unpleasant, but news of a more sensational type.
No, nothing like that. I have here with me an editorial that will appear in tomorrow's edition, August 19th, 1896. It states precisely what kind of newspaper the New York Times will be. So listen, gentlemen, listen. It will be my earnest aim that the New York Times give the news, all the news, in concise and attractive form, to give the news impartially, without fear or favor, regardless of party, sect, or interest involved. That, gentlemen, is what I have in mind for the New York Times.
Memo number three to students of journalism. This statement was the opening gun in the New York Times' war against the yellow press, that unpleasant phenomenon that had begun to flourish in the 1890s. This was the kind of journalism that Adolph Ox was to fight all his life. And as if to emphasize his stand, he introduced upon the New York Times masthead during his first year as publisher the famous challenging slogan,
"All the news that's fit to print."
Did you see today's Times? Now, if that isn't arrogance, what is?
That slogan is not only arrogant, it implies approval of censorship.
It's snobbery of the worst kind.
The rival press raged over the insult they read into the slogan, and they tried to embarrass the Times into retracting it. He even sent reporters to interview the publisher.
You mind making a statement to a rival paper, Mr. Ox?
That depends. On what?
On the Times slogan, all the news that's fit to print.
What about it?
Well, you know what Charles A. Dana of the Sun once said? Whatever divine providence permits to occur, I am not too proud to report.
So?
Well, your slogan seems to imply that you'd censor what divine providence permits to occur.
I'm talking about news, not acts of God.
Well, Mr. Ox, what would you say was unfit to print?
I'm surprised that you, a reporter, should ask that. You really want to know?
Well, of course.
What's untrue, young man? That's what's unfit to print. What's untrue?
And the slogan stayed on the pages of the New York Times. This was the first of many changes Adolph Ox was to introduce in the Times during that first crowded year. He had a clear, strong vision of the responsibility of journalism, and he intended the Times to come as near the ideal of strict truth and impartiality as was possible. At the same time, he wanted a quality paper with new, positive achievements.
Memo number 4. 3 weeks after Adolph Ox took over, a Saturday edition of the New York Times appeared with a new supplement, a new section called the Times Illustrated News. It was a magazine section, the like of which had never been seen in American journalism before. It contained neither comics nor sensational articles. It was printed on good paper. It used serious articles written by authorities in their respective fields. And 1 month after this, Adolph Ox pioneered again. He added another supplement to the Times, one that has been imitated by various newspapers ever since.
Ah, yes, madam. What can I do for you?
I want to buy a book.
A book? Oh, yes, of course, a book. And what one does madam wish?
Well, to be perfectly frank, I don't remember its name.
Well, then perhaps madam recalls the author.
No, I can't remember that either.
Yet madam wishes to buy a book. Will any book do?
Oh, mercy, no. I must have that one. It's for Cousin Henry, and I know he'd love it. Oh, I'm sure you know which one it is.
Yes, but madam, my...
It was on the left-hand column, under that pretty picture of the Alps in winter, and next to that lovely poem about the pussy willows.
Oh, madam, you overwhelm me. What column? What pussy willows
in
winter?
In that newspaper. Oh, I'm sure you know what book I want.
That newspaper? No, I don't. Oh, yes, the Times. The Times book review section.
Yes, that's it. Oh, you see, you do know what book I mean.
The innovation of the Times book section played an important role in the rejuvenation of the Times. The newspaper under Adolph Ox made enormous strides forward.
September 1896, circulation 10,000. October 12,000.
Isn't the Times Illustrated News section wonderful? All those photographs.
November 15,000.
Sure, I read the Times. They've got the market reports so a man can understand them.
December 20,000.
The Times is about the only paper I'm not afraid to let my daughters read.
January 1897, circulation 22,000.
No one who knew anything about the newspaper business believed that Adolph Ox could revive the Times. But amazement took the place of disbelief as the New York Times circulation began to climb. Those first pioneering years were vivid and momentous ones in publishing history. A new force had appeared on the journalistic horizon.
Fifty years have passed since the day when Adolph Ox assumed control of the shattered Times. When he took over, the newspaper was the white elephant of the New York publishing scene. No editor or managing editor, although offered large sums to resurrect it, would go near the Times. Adolph Ox did, and he built it into one of the great metropolitan dailies of the world.
He built it from a newspaper that had nothing but its name. Built it into a powerful institution and with readers in every major capital of the globe. With 21 presses printing 550,000 copies of the New York Times each day and a million on Sunday. With news machines, teletypes, wireless, telephones delivering a million words a day to its editorial offices. With a local reportorial staff of 180 newspaper men and some 400 correspondents in all the cities of the United States. He built it into one of the great sources of reference for the history of our times.
Some writers on polar exploration have written in various articles and journals that Admiral Parry's conquest of the North Pole took more than 37 days. How they arrive at such a conclusion is beyond the understanding of this writer. Admiral Perry's own records, see footnote page 202, footnote 202, 99, 200, 202, footnote. According to the New York Times of September 9th, 1909, which published Commander Perry's own account of his journey to the North Pole, he left Cape Columbus on March 1st and arrived at the pole on April 6th, which is exactly 37 days.
Perhaps few newspapers in America are used as much as the New York Times as a reference. Its daily recording of events, its complete documentation of fact and statistics, makes the Times one of the most frequently quoted sources of all.
My opponent, my worthy opponent, has stated that our government was opposed to the project we are debating here today. It is my belief that the government was never opposed to it. I challenge my opponent here and now, before this distinguished assemblage, to prove his statement. And it is my belief that he cannot.
I take up my opponent's challenge. It just so happens that in my pocket I have a newspaper clipping, purely by accident. It is from the New York Times of January 5th, 1924. And it says, quote, today's
The objectivity of news treatment that Adolph Ox strove for has made the New York Times something that libraries preserve. There is hardly an important library in America that hasn't complete files of the New York Times, either in original copies or on microfilm for easier handling. To these libraries, to this fountain of information, come hunters after facts, research workers, statisticians, social workers, students, writers, all digging through the old files of the Times to implement their facts. For researchers everywhere, the New York Times has become an authoritative, historical source.
Memo number 5 to students of journalism. Do you want to be a foreign correspondent? Give yourself this simple test. Repeat after us without a break.
München, Ausgurter Dammerung, September 15, German Fraus, 10 a.m. EST. Today paraded public square, period, demanding ration, increased comma. 1,000 updress Sunday clothes, march, shouted, period. MPs led Captain John Smith, New York City, dispersed them, period. Quiet restored, 12 noon, period, none arrested.
Cablese, the strange language of overseas news wires. Well, did you get an A in that test? Now all you have to do is this.
So, you want to be a foreign correspondent on the New York Times?
Yes, sir.
You want to go into the romantic capitals of the world and unearth the secrets behind international intrigue?
Yes, sir.
And maybe someday write a book like Inside the Breadbasket of Europe.
Well, I don't know about a book, but, well, maybe an article.
Well, Daddy, I'm looking at you and estimating. I think you'd make a swell foreign correspondent. Yes, just the type. Not bad looking. Dashing, almost. Uh-huh. You come in just at the right time. You know you got a job.
You mean that?
Yep, I'm going to start you in right away. Here, start running this copy to the sports department.
Running copy? But that's a copy boy's job.
That's only the beginning, Larry. After that, you can be a cub reporter. Later on, I'll put you on the local police beat. And you can stay there for a while. Then one day, I'll call you in and I'll say, Johnny, you can start covering national news. You're slowly becoming a foreign correspondent all the time, laddie. I can see it coming out in you. It's coming to a fine boil. My instincts about your abilities have been proven 100% right. And then, when you're really hot, I'll make you a foreign correspondent.
Well, how long will that take?
Well, seeing it's you and all that ability you got, it shouldn't take long. No, I'd say about, 10, 20, 30 years.
It takes a long time to make a good foreign correspondent. The men whose names you see at the top of news stories from overseas are men who were veteran reporters long before they joined the foreign staff of their paper.
Memo number 6. In most of the capitals of the world, the New York Times maintains a foreign bureau whose job it is to file and gather the news, just as any news staff does in America. Today, the National Hour is going to bring you one of these foreign bureaus of the Times. We're going to find out something about the way they work, and at the same time, learn what stories will appear in tomorrow's edition. We are going to cross the Atlantic. We are going to bring you London. Come in, London.
Of NBC, speaking from the heart of England's newspaper row, from 85 Fleet Street, where the lights of the New York Times Bureau cast a warm glow on the wet streets of London. Here is the Times London Chief of Bureau, Mr. Herbert Matthews.
London has to be our largest bureau because in the long run there is more American interest in what happens here than in any other single spot on the globe. The news means more to Americans, linked by ancestry or interest to the British Empire. We have to watch the development of this Labour government, which is trying the first great experiment in socialism with democracy. We have to follow the struggles of the British Empire to maintain some power and to defend its lifelines. The conflicts that center in India and Palestine, the clash of interests with the Soviet Union in the Mediterranean and Middle East, the ever-shifting relations with the rest of the British Commonwealth are just a part of the daily grist for the New York Times mill. The flow of news never ceases, aside from the fact that here in London we receive and relay to New York copy from many other correspondents and bureaus throughout Europe and the Middle East. It is not unusual for 12 or 14,000 words of news to be sent from London to New York for the daily and Sunday editions. They go by wireless for the most part, but often we use cable and sometimes in an emergency the transatlantic telephone. Because we have a margin of 5 hours difference in time in our favor, it is 9:15 in the evening here now, we can send stories as late as 5 or 6 in the morning and make the same morning's newspaper in New York. But on normal nights, we are finished by about 1 o'clock. There are 11 of us to handle this work without counting transmission clerks and office help. And we were lucky in the war, for the largest building on Fleet Street, from where I am speaking, escaped the terrible punishment that was meted out to this section of London by bombs and V-missiles.
This is Merrill Muller in London, returning to the National Hour in New York.
Memo number 7 to students of journalism. It's an example of fine and careful journalism when a newspaper can boil down 1 million words received every day to 100,000 words and still give an honest cross-section of one day's events in this complex world. When a newspaper's objectivity in recording its own times is such that copies become something libraries preserve.
Give me the Daily Bugle.
I want the Clarion.
Hey, got a copy of the Evening Ledger?
The Dispatch, please, and make it snappy.
It goes without saying, not everybody reads the New York Times.
It gives me a headache. Give me a paper with pictures in it. Lots of pictures. I like to look, not read.
Every morning when he comes into the office, that bookkeeper gives me the eye and hands me this newspaper. What is he, insulting me? Not even a crossword puzzle in it. Not even an advice to the lovelorn.
Each individual demands something special from the newspaper he reads, and he sticks to the one that fulfills his needs. The New York Times is one newspaper out of some 1,700 published in America. It serves a certain need. It stands for a certain thing. And in this, the great variety of newspapers published in America, each one standing for a certain thing, we see something of the nature of a free press, the most perfect expression of which is, perhaps, to be found in the salutatory published in the Times on August 19, 1896.
To give the news impartially, without fear or favor, regardless of party, sect, or interest involved.
Final memo to students of journalism. 50 years ago, Adolph S. Ox set out to make the New York Times a certain kind of paper. It was to be a monument for responsible journalism. For 11 years now, Adolph S. Ox has been dead. But the institution he built possesses worldwide prestige. Not only does this prestige exist among the Times readers, but also among newspaper men themselves. We have with us today a newspaper man. He is Robert U. Brown, editor of Editor and Publisher. On this 50th anniversary of the New York Times, it's only fitting that a newspaper man give our peroration. Here is Mr. Brown.
Adolph Fox injected a new note into American journalism in 1896 when he pledged the New York Times to give the news and all the news in concise and attractive form, to give the news impartially without fear or favor, regardless of party, sect, or interest involved. Here was something the people wanted. Rising circulation figures on the Times proved that to the new publisher. It must have proven it also to other publishers. The era of newspaper sensationalism did not live long afterwards. Mr. Ox and the Times set the pattern for the honest and impartial news presentation we know today. The man and the paper have been responsible to a great extent for raising the ethics, standards, and integrity of American journalism to their present high level. Newspaper men today hold a high regard for the Times as one of the finest examples of responsible journalism. To them, it is a newspaper of record. It is a library of information on the daily progress of the world. It carries the texts of important speeches and documents in full. It can be counted on to supply the minute details of a news story, which few newspapers have the space to print. The Times is somewhat of a daily textbook on current history, which few newspaper men can afford to be without. Built on the solid foundation of Mr. Ox's journalistic creed, the New York Times has even increased in world prestige since his death. No small credit for this is due to the able leadership of its present publisher, Mr. Arthur Hayes Sulzberger, who has so faithfully adhered to those fundamental principles and directed that institution for the past 11 years. Newspaper men the world over respect the New York Times as one of the world's greatest newspapers.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. The New York Times and its 50 years of history has been the subject of our documentary. And this is what we've learned. That the New York Times was a shattered and bankrupt newspaper when Adolph S. Ox took over control in 1896. That Ox introduced a new kind of journalism in America, a careful and responsible one, and that also he introduced innovations that influenced the development of the modern newspaper as we know it today. That the integrity the Times achieved won for it 500,000 readers daily and 1,000,000 on Sunday, and that the Times' history illustrates something of the nature of a free press. That the Times has become a newspaper that libraries preserve. Its objectivity in handling the news has made it a reliable record of the current of events at work in the world. On the subject of the New York Times, then, our documentary is closed. And this is John McVane inviting you to listen to next week when our subject will be the American Indian. This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York and Washington, and from London, the National Broadcasting Company has presented the 42nd in this series on current problems. Our speakers were Robert U. Brown and Herbert Matthews. John McVane was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.